Hi, my name's Vic, and welcome to my podcast, Crimes from the Peanut Gallery. This podcast covers true crime cases that may not be suitable for young listeners. There may be graphic and violent content. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to my very first episode. The reason behind the name, Crimes from the Peanut Gallery, is a story I'd love to tell. It's really quite cute. My best friend and I, when we're having a good chat, we like to say to my other half, no comments from the Peanut Gallery or pipe down from the cheap seats. It's also a double entendre, as I have a real love for the Peanuts comics. Anyone watching on my YouTube channel can see how much Snoopy paraphernalia I've got around me. We also have two beagles in this house, and I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but Snoopy's actually a beagle. And if you didn't know it, there's a fun fact for the day. What I really want to talk about on my podcast is serial killers from the US, specifically a serial killer from each of the 50 states. I'm going to be starting with my favorite state of all time, North Carolina, for reasons very dear to my heart. One of my best friends is from there. Shout out to you, Jazz, in case you're listening. And also because I was lucky enough to call it home for a brief period of time. I can't forget my favorite color, Carolina blue, and go the Tar Heels. My soft spot is for a little town called Reidsville. So a huge shout out to anyone who's listening from Reidsville. For my first podcast, I'm going to be talking about Henry Lewis Wallace. He was otherwise known as the Taco Bell Strangler, or what he liked to call himself when he murdered women, Bad Henry. We're going to be doing a part one and a part two. So welcome to part one, everybody. Henry was born in 1965 in Barnwell, South Carolina, to a Lottie Mae Wallace and an unknown married high school teacher who left Lottie when he found out that she was pregnant. Lottie actually resented Henry once he was born, as she saw him as the reason behind her relationship failing. During his childhood, Henry lived with his mother, his sister Yvonne, and his great-grandmother. His childhood home, it had no plumbing and no electricity. He actually mentioned during his confession that he was most comfortable when it was dark, cold, and during a thunderstorm. His home had a tin roof, and when it was raining, he said it created a tranquil feeling and it would often lull him to sleep. Henry's childhood, unfortunately, was filled with poverty, neglect, emotional abuse, and violence. His state-appointed psychiatrist during his trial told the court and the jurors that Henry and his sister were forced to beat each other with switches while his mum watched as a form of punishment. It also happened, unfortunately, though, when she was feeling tired, when she was in a bad mood, or just whenever she felt like picking on her children. Henry did remark, though, that it was much harder for him and more painful to hurt his sister than it was to be on the receiving end of that switch, which is quite surprising considering what he did to women. Though, I've got to say, his sister actually had quite the cruel streak as well. She and Lottie would actually dress him up as a girl and parade him around the neighbourhood, allowing children and adults to mock and torment him. You would think with the level of abuse that his sister and him copped, that would actually bond them. It seemed to actually tear them apart. Now, at the age of 7, Henry witnessed a gang rape. He followed 5 or 6 boys into the woods where they were raped a 16-year-old girl. He said that during his confession, this is when his violent fantasies began, as he was actually turned on by the act. He would go on to commit such acts of violence against women later in his life, rather than be appalled by what he'd witnessed. It set off a chain of events that would end in 11 women dying at the hands of Henry. A traumatic event happened to Henry when he was in 6th grade, this time by his father. His father called him, saying all the things that Henry had longed to hear. He'd always wanted to know him, meet him, and he said he'd actually stop by to see him that week. Henry recalled staying home from school that week as he was so excited and he didn't want to miss the opportunity to meet his father. Really sadly, unfortunately, this never happened, and it left him scarred from another parent. And this memory specifically would actually plague him during quiet or busy nights throughout his life. His high school experience was actually quite different, though. When he started high school in 1979, he was really well liked by his peers and teachers, as he was sort of seen as really polite and really easygoing and well-mannered. His mum had actually forbidden him from joining the football team, so he joined the cheerleading team instead, where he was the only male on the squad. And you can imagine at 6 feet, he towered over those girls. But his peers didn't mock him. Rather, he won admiration from those students in school, just because of his eagerness and his passion for the sport. The girls on the cheerleading squad absolutely adored him. He had a really upbeat attitude and he was always super polite to them. He was also elected to the student council. So overall, his high school experience was relatively normal and uneventful. After graduating from high school, he attended the South Carolina State College and Denmark Technical College. He lacked a lot of motivation rather than actual skill. He preferred his job at night time as a DJ, and he called himself the Night Rider, which was really quite foreboding for what he would do later in his life. He was considered funny and easygoing as a DJ, and females even commented they enjoyed the sound of his voice. However, he'd end up losing this job because of his petty crimes, something as small and as simple as stealing CDs. This was actually the start of Henry's criminal career as a burglar and in robbery. After being fired from his job, he decided he didn't want to go back to school, so he joined the US Naval Reserve in 1984. He would stay in the Navy for another 8 years before being discharged, where according to that state-appointed psychiatrist again, he was described as an outstanding seaman who willingly followed all orders given to him and accomplished his assigned tasks in a timely manner. It was noted that his knowledge level was higher than expected of a seaman. During his time in the Navy, he married a high school sweetheart who had been his girlfriend on and off all through high school. During one of those off periods, she actually had a child. But Henry, he absolutely opened up his arms to that little girl, absolutely adored her. And I think some part of him wanted to rectify all the things that had been done to him as a child. And he desperately, desperately wanted a child of his own, but his wife refused to bear any more children. This caused a massive strain in their relationship, and it had actually proved to be the last straw on an already failing marriage. Burglary proved to be his undoing. He was dismissed from the Navy after breaking and entering near the naval base. Given his record with the Navy, he was given an honourable discharge. His wife left him shortly after, and he was forced to move back with his mother and sister, who had actually relocated to East Charlotte in North Carolina. After he left the Navy, he had several jobs in different restaurants. Unfortunately, he was not able to hold down a job, and he ended up being a manager at the local Taco Bell. Wouldn't this prove to be horrible for people? It was during this time he began smoking crack cocaine more frequently. He'd always dabbled in drugs as such. He dated girls on and off, ended up getting one of them pregnant, and became a doting father of a little girl. But it was around this time that he began his descent into killing and raping women. Henry's victims predominantly worked in the fast food industry and were often affiliated with him, whether it be through his job or his girlfriend Sadie McKnight. It's unclear to me how this would have been missed by the police. They were well-liked girls, lovely girls with promising futures, and even some of them were mothers. So how do you miss that he knew them? Wallace's name even appeared in some of the victims' address books. Before his arrest for the murders, he had a burglary record and a prior charge of raping a woman at gunpoint. Yet this was still missed by detectives and prosecutors when they would arrest him for shoplifting after five of the victims had been murdered already. He was let go that same day that he was arrested, and he went on to murder four more women. The next victim would be exactly 16 days after that arrest for shoplifting. I'm now going to go through the 11 known victims. 1990, Tashanda Bethia. They had dated for a brief period of time. He was charged, but never went before a jury. Sharon Nance, that was one meeting, and she was a prostitute. He was charged with her murder as well, but never convicted. Caroline Love, she was Wallace's girlfriend's roommate. Shauna Hawke, Wallace was her boss at Taco Bell. Her mother actually organised and created a support group called the Mothers of Murdered Offspring. 1993, Audrey Spain, she was a shift manager at Taco Bell, worked with Wallace. Valencia Jumper, his sister, and Valencia had become friends at Winthrop University, and he'd already introduced himself to her at her job. Michelle Stinson, She was a friend of Wallace's. She was also a mother. 1 and 3. They were present at the time that their mother was murdered. Vanessa Mack met her through her sister, who worked at Taco Bell. Betty Bacham, she knew Wallace through his girlfriend, who worked at Bojangles. Brandy Henderson, that was tragic. Her infant son was also strangled, but thankfully had survived. Her boyfriend and Wallace were friends. And Deborah Slaughter, she worked one fateful night at Bojangles, so he knew her through Sadie. During his time at the Navy, Henry began his descent into criminal behaviour, starting with breaking and entering, and this led to an arrest in 1988 after he broke into a hardware store where he pled guilty to second-degree burglary and was sentenced to a 2-year supervised probation. However, it was determined by the probation officer that he blew off most of his mandatory meetings. So a bucket load of good that did. In 1990, Henry murdered Tashanda Bathia. She was from his hometown in Barnwell, and he dumped her body in a lake, and she wasn't found for several weeks. He was questioned by the police in regards to her disappearance, but he was never formally interviewed over her murder. He was also questioned in relation to a rape of a 16-year-old Barnwell girl. Once again, though, not charged. In 1991, he was caught breaking into his old high school and radio station where he'd previously worked as a DJ. He stole video and recording equipment and was caught trying to pawn the loot. This led to an arrest and ultimately him being discharged from the Navy. In May 1992, Sharon Nance would meet an untimely death at the hands of Henry. She was a drug user and a prostitute. However, that doesn't take away from her being a victim at all. Henry beat her after she demanded payment for her services. Her body was dumped by the railroad tracks and found days later. He unfortunately would not serve any time for this murder, as it didn't, that's the word I'm looking for, it didn't show the same pattern as the 9 other victims. In June 1992, he murdered Caroline Love, who was his girlfriend's roommate at the time. He would use a key that he'd taken off his girlfriend and let himself into the apartment that she shared with Caroline. When Caroline unexpectedly came home while Henry was there, she promised him that she wouldn't say anything to his girlfriend if he promised to never do anything like this ever again. Rather than being remorseful, this seemed to enrage him as he responded to the request by choking her and dragging her to the bedroom where he raped her while she was barely conscious. While Caroline was fighting for her life and struggling against the attack, he reached for the nearest object, which just happened to be a curling iron. He strangled her to death with that cord. He didn't know what to do next, though. He was faced with quite the conundrum. He didn't know what to do with the body. So rather than admitting to the police what he'd done, Henry wrapped her up in her own bed sheets, put her in a garbage bin, and placed her in the trunk of the car. He also stole a roll of quarters that was on the dresser. He drove her body outside the city of Charlotte and dumped her body where he thought it wouldn't be seen. I think one of the most disturbing facts of this particular murder for me is he went to the police station with his girlfriend, her sister, Kathy, to report Caroline missing. It's recorded that there was no police interview with Wallace at the time, and she was reported as a missing person. This comes up a little bit later, just because they weren't able to connect Caroline to any other murders because she was considered a missing person. 7 months after he killed Caroline, in February 1993, Shauna Hawke was Henry's next victim. He was her boss at Taco Bell. She was a student and she just recently returned home from community college when Wallace would come to her house after a fight with Sadie. According to court records, Shauna let Wallace in willingly to her home where she lived with her mum and chatted away with him for a little over an hour. During Henry's confession, he would say that she flirted and teased him while they talked. He admitted to her that he wanted to have sex with her. She reluctantly agreed, but this was probably because he was her boss and she felt like she didn't have a choice. She cried through the whole ordeal, and after Henry was finished, he told her to get dressed and he placed her in a similar chokehold to the one he had used with Caroline while her back was turned. Once Shauna had died, he placed her in the bath, stole $50 from her purse, and she was unfortunately later found by her boyfriend and mother. And the police interviewed friends, co-workers, classmates, but they were still unable to identify a suspect. One of the most disturbing facts that's come to light is that he attended her funeral and he comforted her mother. He was known to Shauna's family and he was seen to be quite upset at the funeral. Her mother, Denise, went on to create and organise a support group for mothers and called this Mothers of Murdered Offspring. With his drug use really escalating, he was getting desperate for money. So 4 months after Shauna's murder, he would once again murder someone he worked with. Audrey Spain didn't realise the nightmare she was letting into her apartment that night. After smoking a joint together and chatting for a while, he threw her to the ground and he demanded to know the combination to the safe at the Taco Bell. Audrey had no idea what the combination was. He then asked her for her personal banking details, but she'd just gone on a holiday and she didn't have any money. This frustrated Henry, and he resorted to the only way he knew how to deal with this emotion, anger and killing. He placed Audrey in a chokehold, dragged her to the bedroom where he raped her. During his confession, Henry admitted that Spain had become conscious during her rape. She begged for her life and begged for him to not hurt her. He continued raping her and then told her to put her clothes back on and gave her a feeling of safety. But while her back was turned, he put her in another Boston chokehold and until she became unconscious and died. As she lay there, he tied a nightgown and a shirt into a makeshift rope and he strangled her to death. He once again cleaned the victim in their own bathroom, but he left the body on her own bed. But not before stealing a credit card, of course. This was becoming a real pattern for Henry. He would rape and strangle his victims, and adding insult to injury, he would steal from them. Not huge amounts, but certainly enough for a next fix to, but certainly enough to get his next fix for his ever-growing habit. It also showed all the murders showed no forced entry into the victims' homes. It indicated, really, that they knew the murderer. His victims were always clean and washed, so no evidence was left behind. For his next murder, he would use again the same ruse that he'd had a fight with his girlfriend and needed to talk to someone about it. Valencia Jumper was a friend of his sister's who he'd introduced himself to while she was at her job. He would follow the same patterns as the previous murders, raping and strangling Valencia. However, this time round, disposing the body would change slightly. This time, according to his confession, he soaked the body in rum. He would put some food on the stove and he put the flame on high. Wallace removed the battery from the smoke detector and lit her body on fire. His usual pattern of stealing from the victim continued, though. He took expensive pieces of jewellery from her and then he pawned them. Unfortunately, this time around, mistakes were continued by the police department, with the own medical examiner's office declaring that Valencia's death as an accident, even though there were clear signs that it was anything but accidental. This removed another connection for each of the murders. If a police investigation had occurred during this murder, they may have found that the smoke detector's battery had been removed and a very clear pattern was emerging in the deaths of these young women. Chief Medical Examiner Michael Sullivan has been quoted to say, "It was a bad judgment call," a year after finding out that he'd made a grave error in Valencia's death. August 1993, just weeks after Valencia's murder, Wallace would kill a mother of two, Michelle Stinson, who he knew through Taco Bell. She was a 20-year-old student attending college while being a dedicated mother of two boys, who were aged 1 and 3. She would come into the Taco Bell and that's how she became friends with Wallace, which would end up being her biggest downfall as it would lead to her death. Her showing kindness to a man that didn't deserve it is just horrendous. Henry's intention that night when he went to see Michelle was to rape her. So after a little while of talking, he asked for a glass of water. Once again, the victim turned their back and he put her in a chokehold and he raped her right there on the kitchen floor. He changed his method for killing during this murder, choking her, then using a towel to assist with the choking, but she wasn't dying quick enough for Henry's liking, so he stabbed her 4 times with a kitchen knife. Her son walked in during the stabbing and was told to go back to bed. Her body would be discovered by her sons later, but they were too young to know that Mummy was not sleeping. Her body would be later discovered by a friend who had knocked on the door, and the son let him in, telling him, "Mummy is sleeping on the floor." With 5 deaths and or disappearances in the last 15 months, there was growing concerns amongst the African-American community. They were frightened and they were angry. They demanded to know why the police department weren't taking more accountability for what was 31% of Charlotte's population. The police department held an emergency press conference to put Sergeant Gary McFadden, who I've seen on TV shows such as Homicide City, Philadelphia and Charlotte, which details out his career in homicide in these two cities. If you get a chance, watch those TV shows. He's really amazing and he's really cool to watch. There was a huge speculation that the reason he was put in charge was due to him being African American because he'd had no previous experience with any of the 5 cases. It appeared with the birth of his daughter and the increased police patrols around East Charlotte that kept Wallace from continuing to murder, though not really his criminal behaviour. He was arrested for allegedly shoplifting. He was given a court date, for which he never turned up to, for there appears to be no record of an attempt to find him after the warrant was issued. Remember this warrant. It comes up later. After his arrest, it seemed that this gave Wallace a real sense of arrogance. As the police had arrested him, they had no idea that he was murdering these girls. He grew more and more reckless and brazen over the next 4 murders. He became far more violent and far more careless with the victims. His ever-growing addiction to crack cocaine would see Charlotte more frightened than ever, with Wallace upping the ante by murdering 3 women over 3 days. There was a 5-month hiatus between the murder of Michelle Stinson and Vanessa Mack. Unfortunately, this would begin a frenzied murder across the East Charlotte area. Sixteen days after his arrest for shoplifting, Wallace was low on cash and needed a fix. His solution was Vanessa Mack, who he knew through her sister because she worked at the Taco Bell. She had a good job and always had money. Vanessa worked as a medical escort and had 2 daughters aged 7 and 4 months. This time, though, Henry was prepared for murder. He carried a pillowcase under his jacket in planning for what was about to happen. After asking for a hug, which she actually refused, he pulled out the pillowcase and he began strangling her. He demanded her bank card and her PIN number. Henry would once again rape his victim, and this time he strangled his victim with a towel. Her 4-month-old was asleep on the couch during all of this, and thankfully not waking up, as God knows what he would have done if she had. Later that night, when Henry went to get his much-needed money, he realised Vanessa had lied to him about her PIN number, and he was unable to get what he needed. Her mother found her the next morning. It was missed during this investigation that there was a correlation between Taco Bell and Henry Lewis Wallace again. Another missed opportunity by the police department to identify this killer. 2 weeks after Vanessa's murder, Henry's drug habit was now ruling his life completely. He needed money desperately after the failed bank card debacle. He initially went to rob Brandy Henderson, a girlfriend of one of his friends, Vernon Lamar Woods. But Woods was actually unexpectedly home when he knocked on the apartment door. Frustrated by this, he remembered that he actually knew someone else in the complex, Betty. Now, since Betty was an assistant manager at Bojangles, where his girlfriend worked, he thought she would have the code to the alarm and keys or a code to the safe. Using a ruse that he needed to use her phone, she let him into her home. This kind gesture would prove to be really fatal to Betty. Henry grabbed her once he was through the door, demanding the codes. She resisted for a time being, but eventually gave in. Unfortunately for Betty, he wasn't done. The same pattern continued. He raped and strangled with a side of robbery. He took the money from her purse and a gold chain from around her neck. His new behaviour of recklessness starts here. He stole Betty's TV, VCR, and car, as he totaled his own car recently. He later abandoned the car in fear of the police catching him, and he wiped down the car for fingerprints, but forgot about the trunk, which would prove to be his undoing. Today would prove to be one of the worst days in East Charlotte. Two ladies killed by the same hand within 12 hours. His originally intended victim was now home, Brandy Henderson. He knew that her boyfriend wasn't home. He knew that he was at work. He wormed his way into her apartment by saying that he had something for her boyfriend. She had no issue letting him in. Once again, the same pattern played out, demanding money, and he would rape and strangle Brandy. This time, though, Henry would do something even more horrendous. He attempted to kill Brandy's baby through strangulation. Thankfully, that little baby survived. But adding insult to injury, he did steal from her the TV and the stereo, which he ended up selling for $175 for his drug habit. Cracks were beginning to show, though, in his life. Mistakes were being made in his haste to get his next fix. Police were now on high alert with the latest murders. The medical examiner, Michael Sullivan, said the cause of death for the two most recent deaths was strangulation, being that Vanessa Mack's murder was only 2 weeks before. It was noticed that those three were very similar. This led to our lovely Sergeant McFadden calling a meeting with his detectives to compare notes. It was during this meeting that the police realised that Betty and Brandy lived in the same apartment complex. With this new information, the police contacted the families of those victims and asked them for a list of people that the women would let into their apartments. Henry Lewis Wallace appeared on all three of those lists. On March 3rd, 1994, Betty's stolen car was recovered. This would prove to be Wallace's undoing, as he'd forgotten to wipe down his prints on that trunk of that car. A handprint was identified and matched to Henry. Sergeant McFadden ran Wallace's name through the records database, and the results were not great. Burglary, an armed rape, and that outstanding warrant because he failed to appear in court. A citywide hunt had begun for Henry Lewis Wallace. Whilst all of this was happening in the background, Wallace was on his way to murder his final victim, Deborah Slaughter. Deborah used to work with his girlfriend at Bojangles. He was jonesing for another fix, and he knew that she smoked crack as well. He went around there, hoping to talk to her into buying some crack with him. He wanted to go halves on $60, but she flat out refused. She had some rent to pay and wasn't really interested. The same pattern arose. Wallace asked her for a drink, and with her back turned, he put a towel around her neck and threatened her. And so it all began again. After Henry had raped her, he demanded money from her. She gave him $40, but she was a fighter. She kicked, slapped, and screamed as much as she could. This proved to be futile, as Henry stuffed a sock into her mouth, tied another towel around her neck, and he grabbed a knife and stabbed her 38 times. He really likes to add insult to injury to most of his victims, because he came back later to the apartment a few hours and smoked crack in the same bathroom where Deborah lay dead. That's the end of episode one. Thank you all so much for listening or watching. I really look forward to you watching part two. Thank you.